Cardinal Randolph, has the Church determined the, status of motis? That is, their place in the theology of... Of course not. But I can say they are hardly supernatural beings. Cardinal Randolph laughed, and so did the commentator. There was no sign of the man who had been screaming in rage. Come, the master said. You will have time for this later. They went into the large room and sat at the table. Charlie brought grain from their food supply.
You have smelled the air, Jock said. No industrial development. The planet must be nearly empty. Room for a billion masters and all their dependents.
Too much of this sunlight would make us blind. The gravity would shorten our lives.
Charlie inhaled deeply. But there is room, and food, and metal. The gravity be cursed with the sunlight. We'll take it.
I must have missed hearing the offer, Jock gestured amusement. I do not believe the three of us will take it by force.
These humans drive me to thoughts of Crazy Eddie. Did you see? Did you hear? The mediator for the Emperor detests the operators of the Tri-V cameras, yet he makes expression of pleasure for them, and implies that he may not have the power to prevent them from annoying us.
They have given us a Tri-V, the Master said.
And it is obviously what the humans watch. There were spokesmen for many masters. You saw.
Jock indicated pleasure.
I will have many opportunities to discover how humans are ruled and how they live.
They have given us a source of information which they do not control, the master said.
What does this mean?
The mediators were silent.
Yes, said Ivan. If we are not successful in our mission, we will not be permitted to return.
He indicated indifference. We knew this before we left. Now it is more vital than ever that we establish trade with humans as quickly as possible, or determine that intercourse with humans is undesirable, and find a way to prevent it. You must act quickly.
They knew.
The mediators who proposed their mission, and the masters who consented, had recognized the time limits before they left Mote Prime. There were two. The lifespan of a mediator was not long, and the master would die at nearly the same time. The massive hormone imbalance, which made him sterile and permanently male, would kill him. But only mules and a sterile keeper could be sent, for no master would entrust any but a keeper with this task, and only a keeper could survive without breeding. The span of the second time limit was not so predictable, but it was no less sure. Civilization was again doomed on the moat. Another cycle was turning, and despite the inevitable crazy eddies, there would be no halting it. After the collapse, the humans would see motis in savagery. The race would be helpless, or nearly so, and what would the humans do then? No one knew, and no master would risk it.
The humans have promised discussions of trade. I presume the mediator will be their instrument. Also perhaps Mr. Barry, or another like him.
Jock left his chair and examined the paneled walls. There were buttons concealed in filigree, and he pressed one. A panel slid open to reveal another Tri-V, and Jock operated it.
What is there to discuss? The master demanded. We need food and land, or we must be left alone with the cycles. We must conceal the urgency of our needs and their reasons. We have little to trade but ideas. There are no resources to expand. If humans wish durable goods, they must bring us the metals to make them from. Any drain of resources from the moat would prolong the next collapse, and that must not be.
The Navy's keeping it a big hush-hush, but I can tell you this. They've got technology beyond anything the First Empire ever had.
A commentator on the viewscreen said he seemed awed.
The humans no longer possess much of what they had, said Jock.
Once, during the period they call the First Empire, they had food conversion machinery of amazing efficiency. It required only power and organic matter, garbage, weeds, even deceased animals and humans. Poisons were removed or converted.
Do you know the principles? Or how widespread was its use?
Or why they no longer possess it? The master demanded.
No, the human would not speak of it.
I heard, Charlie added. He was a rating named Dubček,
and he was attempting to conceal the obvious fact that humans have cycles. They all do.
We know of their cycles, Ivan said. They're oddly erratic cycles.
We know what the midshipmen told us in their last hours. We know what the others have implied. We know they are in awe of the power of their first empire, but have little admiration of their previous civilizations.
Little more. Perhaps with the Tri-V I can learn. This food machine, will others know more of it?
Yes.
If we had a Brown, and with what the humans know of the principles, it is possible that—
Make me joyful beyond dreams, said Charlie. Cease to wish we had Browns. I can't help it. I have only to lie on their couches or sit in this chair, and somehow my thoughts turn.
A Brown would die revealingly. Two Browns would breed and breed and breed, and if prevented from breeding, would die revealingly. Shut up about Browns.
I will. But that one food machine would stave off any new cycle for half a 144 years.
You will learn all you can about the machine, Ivan directed, and you will cease to speak of Browns. My couch is as badly designed as yours.
The grandstand was in front of the palace gates, and it was filling with humans. More temporary structures stretched in both directions down the roadway, as far as the Motis could see from their place in the front row. Humans swarmed around and into them. Ivan sat impassively. There was no understanding the purpose of all this, but the humans were attempting to observe the proprieties. As they left their rooms, they were followed by humans with weapons, and the men did not watch the Motis. They looked unceasingly at the crowds around them. These Marines were not impressive, and they would be as meats in the hands of warriors, but at least the human masters had provided a bodyguard. They were trying to be polite. The mediators chattered as mediators always did, and Ivan listened carefully. Much could be learned from mediator conversations.
Jock, these are the overmasters of this planet, of 20 planets and more, yet they have said that they must do this thing. Why?
Charlie,
I have theories. Notice the patterns of deference as they approach their seats. Viceroy Merrill assists Sally to climb the stairs. Titles are omitted by some and always used by others, and given redundantly in full over the loudspeakers. The gentlemen of the press would seem to have no status at all, yet they stop whom they please. And although the others will prevent them from going where they will, they are not punished for trying.
Jock, what pattern do you see?
I find none.
Ivan, have you conclusions?
Only interesting questions, Charlie replied.
Ivan, then allow me my own observations.
Jock changed to the trailing Trojan's recent tongue.
What pattern do you see?
Charlie answered in the same language.
I see a complex netting of obligations, but within it there is a pyramid of power. No one is truly independent, but as you near the top of the pyramid, power increases enormously. However, it is seldom used to its fullest. There are lines of obligations that reach in all directions, upwards, downwards, sideways, in a totally alien manner. Where no master works directly for any other, these humans all work for each other. Viceroy Merrill answers commands from above, and obligations from below. The Browns and farmers and warriors and laborers demand and receive periodic accounting of the doings of their masters.
Jock, astonishment.
It is too complex.
Yet we must know, or we cannot predict what the humans will do.
Charlie, the patterns change as we look, and there is this attitude they call formality.
Shock.
Jock,
yes, I saw. The small female who ran in front of the car. Look, the men in the car are shaken, perhaps injured. The car stopped very suddenly. What prerogatives could that female have?
Jock,
if that is her parent carrying her away, then she is a proto-engineer. Except that she is a small female, and they have few female engineers, and that master's car stopped to avoid striking her, to the detriment of the master. Now I understand why their fjunchs go mad.
The stand was nearly full, and Hardy returned to his place beside them. Charlie asked,
Can you explain again what is to happen here? We did not understand, and you had little time.
Hardy thought about it. Every kid knew what a parade was, but nobody ever told children. You took them to one instead. Children liked them because they were strange and wonderful things to watch. Adults, well, adults had other reasons.
He said, "A lot of men are going to walk past us in regular patterns. Some will play musical instruments. There will be vehicles carrying displays of handiwork and agriculture and art. There will be more men walking, and groups of them will be identically dressed."
"And the purpose?"
Hardy laughed. "To do you honor, and to honor each other and themselves, to display their skills, and maybe to show their power. We've been having parades since history began, and there's no sign we're about to give them up."
"And this is one of those formal events you spoke of?"
"Yes, but it's supposed to be fun, too." Hardy smiled benevolently at his charges. They did look funny in their brown and white fur and their bulbous black goggles, held on by straps, because they had no noses to support ordinary glasses. The goggles gave them an unnaturally solemn look. Hardy glanced at a rustle behind him. The Admiralty staff were taking their places. Hardy recognized Admiral Kutuzov with Fleet Admiral Cranston. And the Moties were chattering among themselves, their voices warbling up and down the scales, their arms flickering.
"It is he! It is Lenin's master!"
Jock stood upright and stared. The arms indicated surprise, joy, wonder. Charlie studied the attitudes of the humans as they moved in the broken space of the grandstand. Who deferred to whom? In what fashion? The similarly dressed ones reacted predictably, and designs on their clothing gave their exact status. Blaine had once worn such clothing, and while he did, he fitted into the place theory would assign him. Now, he did not wear it, and the patterns were different for him. Even Kutuzov had bowed to him. And yet, Charlie observed the actions of the others, and the facial attitudes, and said,
"You are correct. Be cautious."
"Are you certain?" the White demanded.
"Yes. He is the one I have studied for so long, from so far away, solely from the behavior of those who took his orders. Look, the broad stripe on his sleeve, the ringed planet symbol on his chest, the deference of Lenin's marine guards. Certainly it is he. I was correct from the first. One being and human."
"You will cease to study him. Turn your eyes front."
"No. We must know of this type of human. This is the class they choose to command their ships of war. Turn around." "You are a master, but you are not my master."
"Obey," said Ivan.
Ivan was not good at argument. Charlie was. As Jock twitched and stammered in internal conflict, Charlie switched to an ancient, half-forgotten language, less for concealment than to remind Jock how much they had to conceal. "If we had many mediators, the risk would be tolerable. But if you should go mad now, policy would be decided by Ivan and me alone. Your master would not be represented."
"But the dangers that threaten our world."
"Consider the record of your sisters. Sally Fowler's mediator now goes about telling masters that the world could be made perfect if they would exercise restraint in their breeding. Horace Berry's mediator."
"If we could learn."
"Cannot be found. He sends letters to the most powerful masters, asking for offers should he change allegiance, and pointing out the value of information he alone possesses. Jonathan Whitbread's mediator betrayed her master and killed her own Fionch." Charlie's eyes flickered to Ivan. The master was watching, but he would not understand. Charlie changed to the common tongue. "Captain, my Lord Roderick Blaine's mediator went Crazy Eddie. You were present. Gavin Potter's mediator is Crazy Eddie. Sinclair's mediator is useful in society, but quite mad."
"This is true," said the White.
"We have placed her in charge of a project to develop force shielding, such as the humans possess. She works startlingly well with Browns, and uses tools herself. But with her master and her sister mediators, she talks as if her parietal lobe were damaged." Jock sat down suddenly, eyes front. Consider the record, Charlie continued. Only Horst Staley's mediator is sane by any rational standard. You must not identify with any human. Certainly this should pose no hardship. There cannot be any evolved instinct in us to identify with humans. Jock changed back to trailing Trojans recent. But we are alone out here. What then should I be, Fionch, too, Ivan?
You will be no humans, Fionch, Ivan stated.
He had heard only the concealing language change. Charlie made no answer.
Glad that's over, whatever it was, Hardy thought.
The Moti conversation had lasted only half a minute, but there must have been a lot of information exchanged, and the emotional content was high. David was certain of that, although he could as yet recognize only a few phrases of any Moti tongue. He had only recently become certain that there were many still in current use.
"Here come the Viceroy and the Commissioners," Hardy said.
"And the bands are starting. Now you'll know what a parade is like." It seemed to Rod that the very rock of the palace trembled from the sound. 100 drummers paced by in thunder, and behind them a brass band blared some march ancient in co-dominium times. The leader raised his mace, and the group countermarched before the reviewing stand to polite applause. Batons swirled as girls tossed them high in the air. "The ambassador asks if these are warriors," Charlie shouted. Rod almost laughed, but carefully controlled his voice.
"No, this is the John Muir High School Band, a youth group. Some of them may become warriors when they're older, and some of them will be farmers or engineers or..."
"Thank you," the Motis twittered. Not that we haven't had warriors, Rod thought. With this reception sure to have the biggest Tri-V audience in the history of the Empire, Merrill wasn't going to neglect the opportunity to display a glimpse of the mailed fist. It might make prospective rebels think twice. But there hadn't been much military equipment displayed, and there'd been more young girls with flowers than Marines and soldiers. The parade was interminable. Every provincial baron had to show off. Every guild, corporation, town, school, lodge, anything. They all wanted in the act, and Fowlard said, "Let them all come." The John Muir School Band was followed by a half-battalion of Covenanter Highlander troops, with kilts, more drums, and squealing bagpipes. The wild music grated on Rod's nerves, but he was careful to control himself. Although Covenant was on the other side of the coal sack, the Highlanders were naturally popular on New Scotland, and all New Scots either loved or professed to love the pipes. The Highlanders carried swords and pikes, and wore bearskin shakos nearly a meter high. Waves of bright plaids streamed from their shoulders. There was no threat visible, but the reputation of the Covenanters was threat enough. No army in the known worlds would relish tangling with them when they took off their ceremonial finery and put on body armor and battle dress, and Covenant was loyalist to the core. "Those are warriors?" Charlie asked.
"Yes, they're part of Viceroy Merrill's ceremonial guard," Rod shouted. He stood to attention as a color party marched past, and had to make a strong effort to keep his hand from rising to the salute. Instead, he took off his hat. The parade went on. A flower-covered float from some new Irish barony, artisans' guilds displays, more troops, Friedlanders this time, marching awkwardly because they were artillerists and tankers, and hadn't their vehicles. Another reminder to the provinces of just what His Majesty could send against his enemies.
"What do the Motis make of all this?" Merrill asked out of the corner of his mouth. He acknowledged the colors of another baronial float.
"Hard to say," Senator Fowler replied.
"More to the point is what the provinces will make of it," Armstrong said. "This sure will be worth a visit by a battlecruiser many places, and 'tis far cheaper."
"Cheaper for the government," Merrill said. "Hate to think what was spent on all this. Luckily, I didn't have to spend it."
"Rod, you can make your exit now," Senator Fowler said. "Hardy'll make your excuses to the Motis."
"Right, thanks." Rod slipped away.
Behind him, he heard the sounds of the parade and the muted conversation of his friends.
"I never heard so many drums in all my life," Sally said.
"Bosh! Goes on every birthday," Senator Fowler reminded her.
"Well, I don't have to watch all of it on birthdays."
"Birthday?" Jock asked. Rod left as Sally was trying to explain patriotic holidays, and 100 pipers tramped past in Gaelic splendor. 50. The Art of Negotiation. The little group moved in angry silence. Horowitz's hostility was just short of audible as he led the way deeper underground. "I am the most competent xenologist in Trans-Coalsack," he was thinking. "They'll have to go to Sparta to find anyone better. And this goddamn lordling and his half-educated lady doubt my professional word. And I have to put up with it."
There wasn't much doubt about that, Horowitz reflected. The university president had personally made it clear.
"For God's sake, Ziggy, do what they want. This commission is a big deal. Our whole budget, not to mention your department, is going to be affected by their reports. What if they say we don't cooperate and ask for a team from Sparta?"
So, at least these young aristocrats knew his time was valuable. He'd told them half a dozen times on the way to the labs. They were deep underground in the old university, walking on worn rock floors, carved an age before. Murkison himself had paced these corridors before the terraforming of New Scotland was complete, and legend had it that his ghost could still be seen prowling through the rock-walled passageways, a hooded figure with one smoldering red eye. "And just why is this so damned important, anyway? Balaam's ass. Why does the girl make such a big deal out of it?"
The laboratory was another room quarried from living rock. Horowitz gestured imperiously, and two graduate assistants opened a refrigerated container. A long table slid out. The pilot of the Crazy 80 probe lay disassembled on the smooth white plastic surface. Its organs were arranged in a semblance to the positions they'd had before dissection, with black lines drawn across the flayed skin to join them, to points on the skin and the exploded skeleton. Light red and dark red and grayish green. Improbable shapes. The components of a Moti mediator were all the colors and textures of a man hit by a grenade. Rod felt his belly twist within him, and remembered ground actions. He winced as Sally leaned forward impatiently for a better look. Her face was set and grim. But it had been that way back at Horowitz's office.
"Now!"
Horowitz exploded in triumph. His bony finger jabbed at peanut-sized slime-green nodes within the abdomen.
"Here, and here. These would have been the testes. The other Moti variants have internal testes, too."
"Yes," Sally agreed.
"This small?"
Horowitz asked contemptuously.
"We don't know."
Sally's voice was still very serious. "There were no reproductive organs in the statuettes, and the only Motis the expedition dissected were a brown and some miniatures. The brown was female."
"I've seen the miniatures," Horowitz said smugly.
"Well, yes," Sally agreed. "The testes in male miniatures were big enough to see."
"Much bigger than this in proportion. But never mind. These could not have produced sperm. I have proved it. That pilot was a mule."
Horowitz slapped the back of his hand against his open palm.
"A mule!"
Sally studied the exploded Moti. "She's really upset," Rod thought.
"Motis start male, then turn female," Sally mumbled almost inaudibly. "Couldn't this one have been immature?"
"A pilot?"
"Yes, of course," she sighed. "You're right, anyway. It was the height of a full-grown mediator. Could it have been a freak?"
"Ha! You laughed at me when I suggested it might have been a mutation. Well, it isn't. While you were off on that jaunt, we did a bit of work here. I've identified the chromosomes and gene-coding systems responsible for sexual development. This creature was a sterile hybrid of two other forms which are fertile."
Triumph.
"That fits," Rod said.
The Motis told Renner the mediators were a hybrid.
Look, Horowitz demanded.
He activated a lecture screen and punched in codes. Shapes flowed across the screen. Moti chromosomes were close-packed disks, connected by thin rods. There were bands and shapes on the disks, and Sally and Horowitz were speaking a language Rod didn't understand. He listened absently, then found a lab assistant making coffee. The girl sympathetically offered a cup. The other assistant joined them, and Rod was pressed for information about Motis again. Half an hour later, they left the university. Whatever Horowitz had said, Sally was convinced. "Why so upset, sweetheart?" he asked. "Horowitz is right. It makes sense for the mediators to be mules." Rod grimaced at the memory. Horowitz had pointedly added that being mules, the mediators wouldn't be influenced by nepotism.
"But my fiancée would have told me."
"I'm sure she would. We did talk about sex and reproduction, and she said..."
"What?"
"I don't remember exactly."
Sally took out her pocket computer and scrawled the symbols for information recall. The gadget hummed, then changed tone to indicate it was using the car's radio system to communicate with the palace databanks.
"And I don't remember just when she said it."
She scrawled something else. "I should have used a better cross-reference system when I filed the tape."
"You'll find it. Here's the palace. We've got a conference with the Motis after lunch. Why don't you ask them about it?"
She grinned.
"You're blushing."
Sally giggled.
"Remember when the little Motis first coupled? It was the first positive indication we'd had of sex changes in adult Motis, and I went running down to the lounge. Dr. Horvath still thinks I'm some kind of sex maniac."
"Want me to ask?"
"If I don't. But Rod, my fiancée wouldn't lie to me. She just wouldn't have."
They ate in the executive dining room, and Rod ordered another brandy and coffee. He sipped and said thoughtfully, "There was a message with this."
"Oh? Have you talked to Mr. Barry?"
"Only to thank him. The Navy's still entertaining him as a guest." "No, the message was the gift itself. It told me he could send messages, even before Lenin made orbit." She looked shocked.
"You're right. Why didn't we?"
"Too busy.
By the time I thought of it, it didn't seem important enough to report, so I haven't. The question is, Sally, what other messages did he send, and why did he want me to know he could do it?"
She shook her head.
"I'd rather try to analyze the motivations of aliens than of Mr. Barry. He's a very strange man."
"Right, but not a stupid one."
He stood and helped Sally out of her chair. "Time for the conference." They met in the Moti quarters of the palace. This was supposed to be a working conference, and Senator Fowler was running political interference elsewhere so that Rod and Sally could ask questions.
"I'm glad you co-opted Mr. Renner for the advisory staff," Sally told Rod as they got off the elevator. "He's got a, well, a different outlook about the Motis."
"Different, that's the word." Rod had also been assigned others from the expedition. Chaplain Hardy, Sinclair, and several scientists. Until Senator Fowler made up his mind about Dr. Horvath's request for commission membership, they couldn't use him, though the science minister might refuse to become a subordinate to the commissioners. The Marines outside the Moti quarters snapped to attention as Rod and Sally approached.
"See? You worry too much," Rod said, as he acknowledged the salutes.
"The Motis haven't complained about the guards."
"Complained? Jock told me the ambassador likes having guards," Sally said.
"I guess he's a little afraid of us."
Rod shrugged. "They watch a lot of Tri-V. God knows what they think of the human race now."
They entered to hear an animated conversation in progress.
"Of course I expected no direct evidence," Chaplain Hardy was insisting. "But although I didn't expect it, I would have been pleasantly surprised to find something concrete. Scripture or a religion similar to ours? Something like that. But expect it? No."
"I still wonder what you think you could have found," Charlie said. "Were it my problem to prove that humans had souls, I shouldn't know where to begin looking."
Hardy shrugged.
"Nor do I. But begin with your own beliefs. You think you possess something like an immortal soul?
Some do, some don't, Charlie said. Most masters believe it. Like humans, Motis do not care to think their lives are purposeless, or that they can and will be terminated. Hello, Sally. Rod? Please be seated.
Thanks. Rod nodded greetings to Jock and Ivan. The ambassador looked like a surrealist rendition of an Angora cat as he lay sprawled on the edge of a couch. The master flicked the lower right hand, a gesture which Rod had learned meant something similar to, I see you. There were evidently other greetings, but they were reserved for other masters, equals, not creatures with whom mediators discussed business.